It's really wonderful to be here with so many friends, and I'm grateful that, you know, you've hung out to the bitter end. My bitter clingers all. Thank you. And I, too, want to thank Lenore for the magnificent job she's done in taking up the baton from Bill Campbell so nicely and keeping this organization rising to ever greater heights, we hope, we pray. I actually, and Jay, I was really so grateful for things that you said, including your mention of Bruce Cole, who did so many wonderful things at the National Endowment for the Humanities, showing that the federal government is not a complete waste when it comes to cultural things. But I'm not going to talk about advanced placement. People had heard enough from me about that lately, and I want to talk about something else. I want to talk about an even more depressing subject, higher education. What I think is an important structural problem in the reform of higher education, and that is what I call the internationalization of the academy. As you may have noticed, the higher education is always in crisis. It's sort of its natural mode of being. The historiography of higher education is very boring in that way. It's always crisis, crisis, crisis. But those of us who remember the 1970s will remember the particular contours of the crisis as it was faced at that time. Hard, seemingly insurmountable demographic facts. The growth of higher education after World War II was stupendous. The worst problem administrators had was slapping up buildings and creating classroom space fast enough to accommodate the oncoming tide of students, GI Bill students, and later the baby boom, the resulting baby boom. By the 70s, that era was coming to an end, and amid the general gloom and political and economic demoralization of the Nixon and Carter years, Christopher Lash called an age of diminishing expectations. For colleges and universities, the demographic challenges ahead seemed not merely challenging, but insuperable. Where would the next generation of 18 to 22-year-olds come from to fill the many classrooms that had been constructed in the quarter century or so since VJ Day? And what was going to happen to that vast array of small private liberal arts colleges scattered across the American landscape like an archipelago of learning? How would these precious pieces of Americana manage to survive? But as we all know, American higher education did not curl up and die in the 70s. It did not even shrink. Instead, it has maintained and added to its empire, showing remarkable creativity and institutional initiative in expanding the roles of higher education and thereby the range of the student population, seeking and catering to the needs of non-traditional students of all sorts and all ages, including a steadily increasing number of foreign students, of whom more in a moment. It did what businesses always do when supply outstrips demand. It found and exploited and created new markets for its goods, meaning new customers, recruited the additional students it needed from fresh and unprecedented sources, helped in this task by ever-expanding sources of student financial aid, Pell Grants, and the federal student loan industry that now looms so large in our own period of crisis, representing as it does over $1 trillion in debt, aggregate debt, more than the total amount of credit card debt in the country. But I digress into another gloomy point. The point is that since in response to the crisis of the 70s, higher education redefined itself with the assistance of Washington, not your Washington, in ways that were responsive to the immediate institutional and economic needs of the moment. I don't mean to imply, in putting it that way, that the change was fueled entirely by opportunism or that the results were not admirable in some ways. The gains in access to higher education, genuine variety in the student body, have been a real advance. College has become a place not merely for the privileged, but a point of departure for those hoping to get a second chance in life, or just to move beyond the constraints of their lives as they found them and shuffle the deck another time. If anything, colleges have gotten too large for its own good. But be that as it may, college attendance has become, as much as home ownership, the other great locus of troubling debt in American middle class life, a key element in the American way of life. But our redefinition of higher education has not been an unalloyed good either. It's presented us with certain dilemmas, and these must be faced up to, particularly in the period of hard retrenchment that appears likely in the fairly immediate future. For example, and this is my subject for today, we need to pay more attention to the internationalization of the American Academy, including the steadily growing numbers of foreign students in our universities, one of the many ways that universities have changed beyond recognition since the 1950s. Such students represent a source of much-needed enrollment, and the resultant tuition revenues, both quantities that would have been less of an existential concern before the demographic trough of the 70s. In 1954 to 55, according to the Institute of International Education, there were 34,000 international students in American universities. By 1984, that number had grown to 342,000. In 2011, had doubled again to 723,000, and is undoubtedly a good deal more than that now. So why, you ask, is this a dilemma? Isn't this something to celebrate? These increases have a positive economic effect on the United States. They contribute, by some estimates, over $20 billion to the economy through expenditures on tuition, living expenses, textbooks, and such. These students generally pay their tuition with personal funds or get support from their home countries and receive very little support from American sources. Compared to American students who have to be lured with discounts and incentives, they're solid paying customers, a bursar's dream. And their presence gives enlivening variety. You notice I don't use the word diversity. I try to avoid that. Variety to our campuses, exposing the American-born to a taste of a larger and more worldly experience. What's not to like about that? And one can take these questions to an even higher level. Isn't the steady stream of foreign students a sign of American academia's superiority, not only in its own eyes, but in the eyes of the whole world? Aren't American universities simply acknowledging the realities of a global economy and emergent world culture when they choose to embrace and compete for the most talented students in the world, irrespective of nationality? As Ben Weldowski has argued in his book, The Great Brain Race, the globalization of higher education is not only inevitable, but highly desirable for the same reasons that competitive free markets with the fewest possible barriers to trade are preferable to those regulated according to nationalist economic strictures. A quote from Weldowski. As students increasingly see themselves as citizens of the world, first at elite levels and eventually among a broader swath of the global population, all forms of academic protectionism should be removed. The American universities that have been establishing international branch campuses in Asia and the Middle East appear to be motivated by just this vision of things and the hope of profitability flowing from another lucrative market. Yet there are stubborn facts that press in on this bouncy and cheerful account of things. For one thing, as educational researchers such as Chris Glass of Old Dominion University have observed, our universities are doing a terrible job with the integration of these international students. Between the cross-cultural inadequacies of our native-born students and the self-congregating, even ghettoizing tendencies of foreign students, the result in many cases has been an increasingly anomic campus life, coming inconveniently at a time of maximum vulnerability for the very idea of the residential college itself. My concern is with another side to the integration problem involving not just the neglect of the needs of international students, which is very considerable, but also the neglect of one of our most fundamental tasks in the American college or university. And to get at this issue, I'd like to offer a personal story, which has the limitations of an anecdote, but I think it has the elements of a counter-narrative that ought to at least make us consider what we're sacrificing in the process of moving down this inevitable road. Several years ago, I spent a year as a visiting professor on the faculty of a small graduate school of public policy affiliated with a mid-sized university. I'm not going to name it because the name is not important here. The school awarded master's degrees in public policy. Its graduates sought the usual kinds of jobs coming out of those programs in state and local government, State Department, Foreign Service, and so on. This particular school was also committed to do something more than professional training, something it regarded as central to its mission. It had a prescribed sequence of courses in the curriculum that sought to teach students about the philosophical origins and constitutional grounding of American society and government. The presence of these required courses, some of which I taught during my time there, reflected an institutional commitment to the ideals of the American founding and the constitutional regime that the American founders established. I thoroughly enjoyed my year there, but one aspect of my experience came to trouble me repeatedly. And that one thing had to do with the school's vigorous and successful effort to recruit foreign students, especially students from China. I didn't blame and don't blame the school for doing it. Like all such institutions, the school was and is highly tuition dependent and saw its endowment drop sharply in the 2007-2008 financial collapse. It could easily find its very future in jeopardy if it were to fail to meet its enrollment goals. Reaching into the foreign student pool for additional recruits was a natural, understandable move, much like the move made in the 70s by colleges and universities more generally to broaden their student body pool. It was a matter of clutching at a life preserver and hanging on for dear life. But there was always the danger that, to paraphrase the biblical saying, by prioritizing the saving of your life, you may be in danger of losing it. If this particular school had been dedicated to the study of physics or music or even anthropology, such a move would have been completely unproblematic. If the Eastman School of Music, an admirable and merit-based institution, were, in following its usual admissions policy, end up with an entirely Asian student body, which is not beyond the realm of possibility, it would not in the least affect the school's mission, its ability to carry out its mission. But it made all the difference for a school created for the formation of American public officials. The presence of so many non-American and non-immigrating students enlivened my classroom, introduced questions and perspectives that would not otherwise have been available. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I cherished these students as individuals. And yet, if I must be honest, and I must be with you, I admit their presence was also a severe constraint on what I was able to do in the classroom. Instead of teaching my students how to appropriate the knowledge of traditions and practices and laws and customs and historical memories that belong to them as Americans and would be central to their lives as American citizens, I found it necessary to teach all of my students as if these traditions were to be regarded neutrally from a social, scientific, or transnational perspective, as one set of ideas in a whole world of ideas carrying no particular weight. The resulting classes were interesting and informative. My Chinese students were in many ways among the most delightful students I've ever had, but I still would contend those classes had become something different from what the school at its inception had intended them to be. The school was insensibly but surely in the process of losing contact with its founding concept. This impressed on me that in addition to all the ideological and political constraints facing teachers and professors who want to convey that heritage, The presence of an internationalized classroom and student body is a serious constraint on what we can do to educate people for citizenship, the topic of our panel. The provenance for the idea of higher education, including education for citizenship, goes back a long way. Thomas Jefferson's 1818 report of the commissioners for the University of Virginia called for each citizen, quote, to understand his duties to his neighbors and country and to discharge with competence the functions confided to him by either to know his rights, to exercise with order and justice those he retains, to choose with discretion the fiduciary of those he delegates, and notice their conduct with diligence, candor, and judgment. And to develop the reasoning faculties of our youths, enlarge their minds, cultivate their morals, and instill into them the precepts of virtue and order, and form the statesmen, legislators, and judges on whom public prosperity and individual happiness are so much to depend. We'd probably be thrown out of our contemporary universities for espousing those things. Now within the academy, the ideological tides have shifted, particularly since the 1960s, and education for citizenship is much less likely to be viewed affirmatively. The influential philosopher Martha Nussbaum has argued that patriotism itself is a disreputable thing, that I quote her, patriotic pride is both morally dangerous and ultimately subversive of some of the worthy goals patriotism sets out to serve. For example, the goal of national unity and devotion to worthy moral ideals of justice and equality, close quote. One more quote from her. Such goals would be better served by the old ideal of the cosmopolitan, the person whose allegiance is to the worldwide community of human beings. And it's the job of the university to instill that ideal and displace the dangerous idols of the nation state. Nussbaum, in this same context, offers as the heroic exemplar of this disposition the figure of Diogenes the Cynic, whose sobriquet doesn't suggest a promising outcome here, but you all know who he is, and he was, of course, said to have answered anyone who asked what city-state he came from by declaring, "I am a citizen of the world." He heroically declined, Nussbaum says, to identify himself with the accidents of birth, local origins, group membership, central to the self-image of the conventional Greek male. Almost said straight white male, but instead he defined himself in terms of more universal aspirations and concern, and we're urged to do the same. This view dovetails very nicely with the Ben Weldovsky view of the transnational global university, whose smooth surfaces have no place for robust expressions of national identity, civic consciousness, community of historical memory. A striking example of this is given in the historian John Fonte's very fine book, Sovereignty or Submission. Fonte notes a recent advertisement at the time of his book was published, appearing in Foreign Affairs magazine for New York University's Center for Global Affairs. The advertisement pictures two young people standing in front of the UN building in New York with a caption that asks the following question: "As a global citizen, to whom do I pledge allegiance?" The point of the ad, as Fonte argues, is to attract students to the center by associating the center with skepticism about the concept of national loyalty, support for the idea that once the global citizen is affirmed, the more particular loyalties of an American citizen must disappear or be subordinated. Well, cosmopolitanism is always the preferred mode of affiliation for university intellectuals and international businessmen. But it's not an ideal that encourages the perpetuation of deep loyalties and the willingness to sacrifice and bear others' burdens. It's not an ideal that involves imposing, demanding civic duties grounded in the concrete realities of ordinary life in real families, real communities, and real political society. In fact, it may be a morally satisfying avenue of escape from them, in precisely the way Diogenes freed himself from them, permitting himself to do so in the name of a putatively higher calling. The result, though, is that we've come to neglect what has always been understood as the primary goal of education, or a primary goal of education, the formation of reflective and responsible citizens. We are paying the price for that neglect today, with all too many Americans, even nominally well-educated ones, who do not understand their own political and economic systems, who are appallingly ignorant of the American past, and are bereft of any sense of love for or profound connection to their own nation and its traditions. Needless to say, such citizens will have neither the intelligence nor the heart to be able to meet the rigorous challenges of what is shaping up to be a very demanding future. We will have to do better and start doing so very soon if we want to keep our Republican form of government. Many questions remain. I can't answer very many of them, but I have a little bit of an answer to some of them. One question, what kind of education ought we to insist on? How can we improve on the one we now provide? How should curricula, not only of colleges and universities, but primary and secondary schools, be adapted to fit the civic educational needs of the present and future? And to these considerations, I'd add another question. How can we foster these things while holding on to what is good and valuable in the cosmopolitan perspective? And for that question, I offer the beginnings of an answer. It lies in recognizing that the cosmopolitanism of Martha Nussbaum, the cosmopolitanism in full, so to speak, is an ideological cosmopolitanism, but is actually a variety of provincialism, a set of all too finite loyalties that attempt to dispense with the most fundamental facts of our inescapable particularity, the facts of our natality, of our birth, the parents we have, the places from which we come, the religion in which we are raised, and the circumstances that have shaped us and made us who we are. A truer cosmopolitanism will not seek to deny or erase these things and will not forget that citizenship, rightly understood, always and necessarily means citizenship of some place in particular. The lesson for me of Diogenes is that the citizen of every place is the citizen of no place. A better cosmopolitanism will more clearly understand its own inherent limitations. Such an answer will have implications leading in many directions, but it ought to make us think twice about going along in a mindless and uncritical way with the transformation of the academy that's being urged upon us as a fait accompli and an unquestioned good. At the same time, it might make us turn with renewed appreciation to the ancient and venerable American idea that education is about our being a land of second chances, a kind of national exceptionalism, that even the internationalized American academy at its best can embody. I'm not without hope in this. Indeed, it is entirely possible to have an internationalized student body and still be serious and effective in the task of educating students for American citizenship. But it will not happen unless we renew our confident, proud commitment to the distinctive meaning and value of that citizenship, our citizenship, and begin to think more concretely and honestly and responsibly about what we really ought to accomplish with our institutions of education at all levels, beyond filling our enrollment needs and keeping the institutional ship afloat. Thank you.